This week in the NeuroClinic, we're joined by Oliver Turnbull, neuropsychologist and clinical psychologist and professor at the University of Bangor in Wales. Oliver, together with his co-authors Rudy Kurtzer and Christian Salas, recently published an excellent book on mistakes in clinical neuropsychology. We talk about the book, and if you listen carefully, you'll hear Oliver admitting to one of his biggest mistakes, that of agreeing to come on the podcast in the first place, and furthermore, agreeing to return at some point in the future. Thank you, Professor Turnbull. Welcome to the NeuroClinic, Professor Oliver Turnbull. I'm delighted to have you here. I should say, Shamai Borodar, because of course you are based in a lovely part of the world in sunny North Wales.
I am indeed. We don't actually say Shamai here. The locals tend to say Tin Yaun. How are you?
I knew. We just discussed before the meeting that what do the locals say?
Tin Yaun.
Tin Yaun.
So, yes, and I am. Other people think that I'm a fluent Welsh speaker now. I'm not as fluent as you think, but I suppose once you've published your first book on a topic, it's hard to argue that you're still a learner. So my tutor tells me that I'm a new speaker of the language. Siaradar Nioth Uwer Ian is the technical term. So there we go. But I'm not here to talk about my Welsh.
No, but it's important to acknowledge. I'm based in South Wales, in Monmouth. It's a border town and has all the kind of sort of ambiguities around where it really sits politically and geographically and all of those kinds of things. But I'm very proud to be living in Wales and very much keen on the culture and preservation of it. We're here to talk about your book. But I think first of all, and you've said that you're happy to introduce yourself, perhaps you can tell us a little bit about where you are now in terms of as a neuropsychologist, but also how you came to be interested in neuropsychology.
Yeah, so I'm a neuropsychologist and indeed a clinical psychologist whose main interest, I think, is the very broad topic of the neuropsychology of emotion and things related to emotion. And maybe we might talk a bit more about that later. I'm a professor of neuropsychology here in North Wales in Bangor University, where I've been for just over 25 years now, actually, as it turns out. But I do have a side hustle, which is that I'm the deputy vice chancellor here in the university. I've been in sort of senior management jobs for a bit over a decade now. And I'm still trying to juggle, research and clinical work and trying to run the university's planning process. But again, we're not here to talk about management. So is that enough of an introduction?
No, that's a fantastic
introduction. Something else, which is that a lot of people notice that my accent probably isn't from North Wales originally. I'm a Glaswegian, as it turns out. thank you for laughing at my joke.
No, it's all right. That's very funny.
It is true. I was 7 when I left Glasgow to go to South Africa, which is why I sound a little, transcontinental or whatever the right phrase is. But anyway. So that's my summary. Good enough?
It's very good. And but another question that people will be interested to hear, because I know that people do like hearing about people's personal stories and what hooked you into neuropsychology in the first place. Could you tell us a little bit about that?
Sure. I finished school in South Africa and went to university there. Fortunately for me, actually, the South African system, like the Canadian and the Australian and the American one, follows the Scottish model of a very diverse range of subjects. So I knew I was interested in science. I just didn't know which one yet. And I was very entranced, as many people are, with astrophysics. I did 2 years worth of astronomy and physics, both of which I did just fine at. But calculus and I were not the best of friends. So I needed to try other subjects out in the faculty, and one of them on the list was psychology. To be honest, I wasn't desperately impressed with psychology at the beginning, because it just wasn't sciencey enough for me. It all seemed a bit vague and abstract, and where was the body of knowledge? And then in my second year, I ran into neuropsychology for the first time and some neuroanatomy, and suddenly I'd found something that was science. But it was no calculus. I was fine with the stats that we needed to do. It was the right level for me. I have other reasons why I'm interested in the mind. And it took me a little while to find the right part of neuropsychology for me. I'm interested in emotion now, but back in the 80s and 90s, Emotion and consciousness just weren't themes in the field. It was bad for your career to be interested in that sort of stuff. So it took me a little while to find my natural place. And fortunately, neuropsychology went through, what do we call it, an emotional turn in the sort of latter half of the last century. And now emotion is entirely legitimate, but still heavily underrepresented, would be my little summary. So that's sort of the journey. I wanted to do some science. This turned out to be the right science that suited my sort of skill set, and it's been a massive privilege to be able to study something that I would do even if they didn't pay me. It's
I confessed when we were talking just in the run-up to this recording that I listened to your conversation with PJ Weary this morning on another podcast, dare I say a rival podcast. There are lots of podcasts out there, of course, but your enthusiasm for neuropsychology and communicating what neuropsychology is and how it relates to other aspects of psychology was something that I found really interesting about that podcast. And it was one of the things slightly out of order in terms of our plan. But could I ask you about communicating neuropsychology? Because it's a big part. And we talked a little bit about teaching and teaching about neuroanatomy, but getting messages across is often something that we're quite challenged by. And some of us might see it as a frustration, as a sort of peripheral task, aspect of our work. But it seemed to me implicitly that you see that as quite central to what it is that you're charged with doing. Is that a fair?
I mean, absolutely. I suppose I've been sort of doing it all my career, one way or the other. But they're two different forms of communication. I suppose that the first one is sort of within the field. How do you convince, for example, students who've come to study psychology, that actually the biology stuff, that they may not especially have been interested in when they were, at school, actually is really important. And as that progresses, across their career, it just gets more and more complicated. As I think, I mean, we try to make clear in the book, if you're going to be working in clinical neuropsychology, there's a whole lot of surrounding discipline stuff you need to know, neuroanatomy, neuropathology, basic neurology, for heaven's sake, as well as some other disciplines, and helping to guide students through that journey has been really interesting for me across my career. Sometimes you get students, who probably would have wanted to do medicine if they, if they had better grades, and this is it's exactly it suits their lifestyle completely. And at other times, of course, you get people who maybe don't have that. So I've really been I've tried to get that across, but particularly because I'm interested in emotion, being a sort of champion for feelings. In neuropsychology and for feelings indeed in the mind has been, I suppose, my biggest, a professional journey. And maybe I'll say more about that, as it comes up later. The other communication part you mentioned, though, was, it's not within our field, but it's with our patients. And neuropsychological disorders are bizarre. Oliver Sacks famously has an entire book career. Built at least in part on the fact that it's really strange for people and their families to have them become different individuals and to have a completely different perspective on the mind. I mean,
Yes.
Sacks talks about prosopagnosia, for example, and anosognosia would be another really difficult one to get around. All of those confabulatory disorders, trying to find neglect, trying to speak to families and patients about how to approach that strangeness, I think is an important part of being an ambassador for our field, because we've seen it before. You've been seeing neglect for years, and it's just, and suddenly along comes, your husband, and half of the time he doesn't know where you are. It's very difficult for people to get their heads around.
Yes, and you're absolutely right to highlight there's a bi-directional communication challenge, isn't there? There's understanding the way that patients will describe problems. I work with with children. And I'm kind of fond of a book. I probably won't be able to pull it off the shelf now, but it was about how parents understand children's development. So the more we understand about what parents understand about typical development, the more we can adopt a frame of reference which is consistent with their understanding. And as you say, they've entered into a clinic space that they didn't want to be in this space. They're there because their child's had an awful accident or a stroke or the onset of some pathology. What we need to do is to be able to help. And certainly in my sort of conversations in my role as a supervisor with trainees, etc., I'm very keen that we meet our patients more than halfway, right? So we're not there to educate them about what the difference is between episodic memory and short-term working memory. That isn't going to help. What you can do is hold in mind the construct and have a conversation with someone using their language. And I think that some of the we're going to get onto the book, but some of the mistakes in the book aren't there about accepting at face value the ways that problems are described, and that there's a sort of a tendency for us to be a bit lazy sometimes and not dig beneath the surface of what's being presented to find out, well, actually, what is the person really describing here as a problem?
I agree. And you chose the example of memory. So that's the first of my chapters in the book, isn't it? That I think it's called The Wrong Amnesia, in which I'm the well, it's actually not even the patient, it's the patient's mother, isn't it? Who I, as a joke for our British readers, called Mrs. Merton, who I think would, might have made a few people of a certain age smile. She describes things which she thinks of as memory, but are not, as you say, impairments of recent episodic memory run by, the medial temporal lobes. But I at least in that case, because of course the cases are in some respects parodies, aren't they? But that's the mistake you make, is to go down the wrong, the rabbit hole of not listening like a neuropsychologist, which is that not all memories are made alike. And then you just mentioned that very nice example. Or challenge, I should say, of the fancy words for these in your mind. You can't use that terminology to your client, but you need to find language that will make it understandable. The prototype I always use when I'm teaching are those people turning up with their elderly relatives who have a memory impairment, telling you they can't have a memory impairment because they remember their wedding day with enormous clarity, and it's just. You how to describe that to people without using the word retrograde amnesia is but it's important to try to speak that second language, the using the phrases that the family will understand.
And it's part of the joy of what we do, isn't it? That we're dealing with those kinds of constructs that we hold in mind. We're also trying to have a conversation, maintain a relationship, and understand that somebody might experience this as something that's quite difficult for them to communicate, but also it's quite difficult for them to hear some of the challenge. I suppose I would also sometimes challenge, I wouldn't get out my PowerPoints and say, we need to understand the circuitry that underpins your problems. But I might say, what you're describing doesn't sound like memory as I would think about it. It sounds a little bit like you might have problems encoding information, or you might have problems attending to information. And it's quite important that we distinguish those things, because they would lead to different treatments potentially, right? And it is important that our patients understand and are able to engage, therefore, in the treatment. So we might sometimes bridge to that with the best of intentions to introduce some constructs which are helpful to them. But I would, as I think you're indicating, shy away from the neuroanatomy lectures and the rebuking around using certain kinds of language.
Yeah, no, I agree. You reminded me halfway through that last bit about another challenge, which I think is a little more unique to neuropsychology than it is to some other branches of psychology. So, for example, to the psychotherapies, which is that you're managing two completely different jobs in parallel while you're assessing a patient or their family. On the one hand, you have this technical task of trying to appreciate which psychological processes aren't working, and which brain areas might underpin those, and which pathological process, might be behind that. And that it's a profession in and of itself. But you're also in the room with a human being and their family, perhaps, who have substantial problems. And now you're more like a therapist, maybe even a, you know, a family or a systems therapist, you know, trying to manage this complicated relationship. And it has occurred to me more than once that if nothing else, there are huge working memory demands here. You can't do both of those at full speed. You have to task switch between you know, between managing your relationship with the, you know, with the people in the room and, you know, doing the technical work. And it's partly why, just to return to the book again, you know, we give some advice, I think, in that last chapter about things you might do in order to avoid mistakes.
Yes.
If I remember one of them, I think it's the last one, it's about giving yourself time for reflection, and testing out the ideas after the you know, after the assessment. I do, perhaps just through self-talk, you know, go for a walk in the hospital grounds, or indeed with somebody else, and try to explain, you know, get a sort of a second opinion. We're fortunate, I think, in neuropsychology in that there are almost no emergency situations in which the patient's going to die unless you make a decision on the spot. So you can often have a little bit of time to reflect. And I think that's partly what gets around this parallel processing problem that I described earlier, which is that you can't be a therapist 100% and you know, and a neuroanatomist, dare I say it.
And I know we kind of skipped to the end of the book before we got to the start, and people might be wondering what on earth the title of this book is. But I will come on to that. But I have a you use various kind of sporting analogies in the book, and one of them is about scoring a goal and the build up to scoring a goal and where the work really happens. And I never played football, but I have coached football, and I kind of appreciated that. Also play tennis, and I'm holding up a book here, which is The Inner Game of Tennis, which is
Ah,
about
yes.
flow and
Intuition.
about getting it right and what it feels like to get it right, to hit the ball right, to score the perfect goal. But there's also something, it made me think about stretching that analogy and thinking about there's always a role for VAR, right? So you scored the goal, but you before you celebrate too keenly and before you get too wedded to the fact that that was a goal and now we're ahead and we're going to win the match, there's an opportunity to step back and say, how do we score that goal? You know, who were the key players? What was the build-up like? Did we miss anything? Is there anything that we might want to think more critically about in terms of how that worked? And sometimes we don't just want to score one goal, but we want to win 3-0, right? So we want to make sure that we're not just doing this once. And particularly in the developmental context, so I find myself, I suppose, you know, sometimes our assessments feel like we need to be certain right now about exactly what's wrong, why it's wrong, and what the corresponding treatment might be. But I sometimes encourage, again, sort of my way of working is often to hold your conclusions lightly, think about them, think about the risks of being wrong. So, yes, we can make mistakes, but if we hedge our bets a little bit and we think about what would happen to the patient if we guided them down the wrong path. You know, what are the alternative hypotheses that we've dismissed with good reason, but may well turn out to be true because our kind of P is less than 0.05 threshold for making decisions isn't about certainty, is it? It's about what if this is a type one error? What if
Yeah,
we
no,
said this is a memory disorder and it turns out to be a language disorder? What if we said it's a motivational issue and it turns out to be, have we hedged our bets enough to avoid the consequences of being wrong?
exactly. No, I think neuropsychology, probably more than many other disciplines, you know, runs risks. You can't see the organ that you're dealing with. If this was surgery, you could at least open them up and have a look. You know, there is the opportunity for a scan, but they're notoriously unreliable for a number of, you know, important disorders.
Yes.
So, and also we, neuropsychology, although massive impairment is easy to understand clearly, what constitutes mild impairment is, and is a much more variable thing. It's the reason we do, you know, statistics modules. And also, you know, there are some things that come with individual variability in the normal population based on people's backgrounds and so on. And sometimes a patient can be having a bad day, And there's another type one error, sitting right in there. So that's why I think we one of the reasons why I recommend this, going back, maybe going back on a different day with a parallel test, and seeing what things look like, what things look.
Absolutely. And if we're right, there's nothing to be feared from that process, right? Because what we'll get is further confirmation, usually, that we're right to head down this path. But if there's an opportunity to take a second look and we come up with something which makes things look more ambiguous, maybe we've got the humility to step back and say we were wrong. We should
Yeah, no.
explain the title of the book,
All right.
which it's a great title, isn't it? And I think that it's something that, so it's Mistakes in Clinical Neuropsychology, Learning from a Case-Based Approach. Your co-authors, of course, are Rudy Kurtzer and Christian Salas, who I met both of them, and they're delightful people to work with. And I assume you found them so too, and
I've
obviously have
known
worked with
them.
them for a number of years.
Yeah. No, it is. I smile when you say the title of the book, because it actually came up once when I was as a question when I was giving a talk about it. Someone in the audience said, "Well, I've listened to your examples, and really, I'm not sure that they're mistakes because they are formulations, provisional, which are often
Yes.
called supervision process." And we designed the book a bit like that anyway, so that no patients were harmed in the
Yes, in the
in
making.
writing this document. And I thought about it, and then I said to the person in the audience, "Yes, because I would have sold a lot of copies of the book with a title, provisional formulations in clinical neuropsychology.
Yes.
Not it's not as catchy as mistakes." So
No, but it's a great title, and but I would agree with that criticism, actually, that many of the mistakes are caught, aren't they, and caught in supervision. And I do have a question. I suppose before getting on to that, I thinking particularly about your co-authors and about, and I've heard you talk again on this other podcast about, how we can talk about our mistakes and how we make sure that that process of talking about our mistakes is a safe process. And it does strike me that you've achieved that and yet created a book. At least in terms of my reading of it, there are some suggestions as how we avoid mistakes, which creep into the latter sort of third or so, and certainly into the last chapter. But I found that one of the great things about reading this book is that it creates space for the reader to think about, how might I fall into the same traps? How might I be subject to the same kind of reasoning problems. It strikes me as, nonetheless, quite a brave book to write. And I wondered if your co-authors had any reservations about
Yeah,
being part of that endeavor.
we did more than once. It started actually with myself and Rudy talking about mistakes that we made, and I started, and then Rudy to write chapters, and eventually Christian got involved as well. We've been quite tight for more than a decade now, as a sort of maybe 15 years as a sort of research and a team. What was I going to say? I suppose. The thought that came to mind for us was that more than once, and in fact, we talk about it in the first chapter, people talk about the importance of discussing your mistakes and catching them in supervision, and no one writes about them. Certainly, no one goes to their conference, annual conference, and said, "I'd like to tell you about my best mistake, please," because there's something shameful about acknowledging that we may be imperfect, but yet we all understand that you're trying to learn something difficult and hard to do. And surely we should be more open to talking about it. So I've talked a few times about the book, and I've always got a sort of sigh of relief from members of the audience, including people from medicine who see the way in which people sometimes sweep mistakes under the carpet, refuse to acknowledge to their to their patients and families that they may have made a mistake, and it's just bad for everybody, that sort of situation. So we thought it would be better to get them out in the open. However, we did have reservations that if we describe something which is identifiable to a particular case,
Yes.
all sorts of medical legal
Yes.
cases with all of this, so. We were cautious about just exactly how we reported things, and has at times, what's the right word, made some modifications that would help that. I had a small experience, by the way, with that and the Oliver Sacks book. I'd read The Man Who Mistook His Wife for a Hat, in the 80s, and I had a big problem with the hat story, because I knew the literature on the agnosias, and indeed on neglect and playing chess, and I thought that sex patient can't be real, and I wrote a draft of a paper on the topic, which I must have on my computer somewhere, but I never could bring myself to talk about it. In fact, I met Sacks once, and I thought, well, am I going to confront him about this? And of course, I wasn't brave enough to, and he's such a lovely guy. And then, having written our book, I now understand exactly why Sacks did what he did. There are some things you just need to do, partly to protect yourself, and partly also to make the story clearer
Yes.
than the muddiness of the original. So,
Yes. And I suppose again, it's sort of hearing you talk about that, partly what you're saying is that we clearly need to avoid ending up in the courts, for 15 chapters worth of litigation. But we also need to be respectful to the fact that there are people at the end of this process, and we don't want to talk about the mistakes that we've made that have caused them harm. I suppose it did make me think about, what mistakes have I made, and how would I talk about those, and where do I talk about the mistakes that I've made? And there are one or two mistakes that I do talk about in teaching. I'm careful about how I talk about them. I talk about how they've arisen, but I also do talk about the harm that was caused because of those mistakes. I suppose in describing them as mistakes, a bit like the challenge that you got in that lecture, I don't think of them in concrete terms as mistakes, but they are possibly errors of judgment in a context, in a wider system that were understandable at the time, but have led to a less than optimal course of treatment for an individual. And I guess we have frameworks, don't we? We have frameworks in the NHS. We have a duty of candor legislation, which means that if we do something wrong and we think a degree of harm has been caused, we have an obligation to speak to someone about that and say, look, this shouldn't have happened. We are working hard to understand why it has happened, and we're also working hard to prevent that happening in the future. And that strikes me as a quite a sensible thing for us to do, but it's not quite reached our culture in the way. I mean, famously, people talk about the aircraft industry, don't they? And they say, well, there is a, I think that's being challenged at the moment in various ways, but there's a sense in which mistakes can be made
And
and
they show
talked about in that
in the entire
industry. And
industry,
sorry, go on.
and they've done very well with that. I
Yes.
suppose the other advantage we have is that some of them, neuropsychology and its management or treatment moves more slowly than some other disciplines. If you take the wrong kidney out in surgery, then there's no easy way of going back with that. But there are times in which you can change course partway through. I mean, I think Christian has a great example in one of his later chapters. He hadn't written that chapter, and I said, "You've got my favorite Christian Salas phrase. This is the title of your chapter, my friend, which is called Concrete Patients Need Concrete Therapists." I said, "I don't know what the patient is, but that's the title of the chapter. Please write it." And it's a beautiful example in which he thinks he's doing a good job in offering some sort of therapy to his patient, and then realizes only because the patient he gets to see something that probably otherwise shouldn't have seen. He realizes he's just been treating his patient in an inappropriate way. So he's able to, you can't take the past back, but he can do better in the future.
Yes.
So I think I being ever questioning about whether we might not have made the correct decisions, even if we're partway down a treatment, I think remains a remains an important principle.
One of the questions I had, because I suppose one of the, dare I say it, safer things about the book is that some of these mistakes are made during a process of training and therefore caught by supervisors. So having a good supervisor who will ask you curious questions and kind of pull at some of the loose threads of your arguments is really helpful. I guess as we get more senior, although we might continue to have supervision, we become slightly more vulnerable to being resilient to that kind of influence. We don't have people to catch us in quite the same way. Do you think there's more of a risk? Do you think we continue to make mistakes, or do you think the mistakes that you describe are features of a kind of junior phase of experience?
I mean, plainly, we all make mistakes, and we'll continue to do so. I think some of the mistakes that are in the book, like for example, the wrong amnesia. I talked about earlier. No experienced clinician is going to make that error, and I may have slightly exaggerated the magnitude of the Mrs. Merton mistake as well. But that doesn't mean we won't continue to make them. I think there's something that we talk about in the final chapter, which is a counterweight to that. Which I call developing your intuition. So we know now what intuition is, published a few papers on it, and it is emotion relate based learning, which is founded by multiple experiences of and knowing the consequences of those actions. And as you get more experienced, you should, if we are correct, be able to, and we can listen, hear a sort of internal alarm bell saying, well, this is not actually a bog standard case. There's something that doesn't quite fit here. I think that's the moment in which you need to go and speak to somebody you trust, who could be someone you're involved with supervision in, or just be someone down the corridor. I just don't understand this properly. I just want to, will you listen to me for 5 minutes and tell me whether there's anything else I could do? I like to think that effective clinicians are gradually acquiring that set of intuitive or sort of gut feeling aspects to their work, and that would be my counterweight to the fact that we're all sinners. We're all going to be mistakes, forever.
I think you're absolutely right. I suppose I worry sometimes that we're under pressure, not pressure to be right, and not necessarily under pressure to sidestep supervision and scrutiny, but we are under pressure of time and resource. And I think it can, you mentioned a number of mistakes that I think are about, I mean, there are chapters on cutting corners, but they're not necessarily about ruthless efficiency. But I think the pressures in the NHS in terms of productivity mean there maybe isn't quite so much space for reflection and support with tricky cases as there might otherwise be. I worry sometimes that a report's just kind of fresh out the printer, as it were, and it's grasped by a neurosurgeon and the child is whipped off to surgery. And I'm thinking, would have been nice to have had 48 hours just to kind of, as you say, go for a cup of tea or go to the canteen or something and scratch my head and think about, am I right about this before something irreversible happens?
Yeah, I absolutely agree. I also worry about patients who don't return for follow-up, because if you're very busy and someone DNAs, you can be rubbing your hands and thinking, oh well, I can finish that report now, or you can do something else. But actually, that there could be a reason for that, and I suspect that the patients who are l less likely to turn up are probably the patients who need it more. That would be that would be my concern. I mean, it's not a failure of neuropsychology. It's more a failure of the system. And I know we complain here in Britain about resourcing, but I'm sure anytime you meet somebody from another country, you hear a similar sort of story.
I wanted to ask you about that, about the system. So many of these mistakes are mistakes that are made within the sort of confines of a neuropsychology service, but many of us are working in multidisciplinary community teams. We're working alongside other professions. I work in an epilepsy surgery service in an acute pediatric neurosciences unit. The mistakes, if that you like, that are made that I would see and reflect upon are sometimes made within a system. They're not necessarily individual mistakes, so they might be beyond that pairing of a neuropsychologist and a supervisor. I suppose I wondered if you, I mean, it does seem to me that there are lessons in this book that also extend to that wider system in terms of how it treats cases. You talk about referrals quite a lot, and sometimes the referrals aren't very well put together. And I think, well, if there isn't a good question, maybe there are issues elsewhere, right? So maybe we need to think about, well, how come we don't know this patient's history, or the medical history isn't very well documented in the referral letter? Perhaps that suggests an absence of care and diligence elsewhere in the system.
Yeah, you're right. I mean, the more than once in the book, I do, or we reflect that we just wish we'd gone back to the person who'd referred, who'd written the note and said, "What on earth do you really want here?" Because, saying that is this person's brain working normally is not it's not a sensible question for a modern neuropsychologist. We need something, much more precise than that. The other MDT thing that comes up, and I think we talk about it in the beginning of the last chapter, is about acquiring your knowledge base, and that I mean, hopefully it's better in good training systems than what it was with, we who wrote the book trained in, the previous eras, and being thrown into a medical setting when your primary training is not in medicine is terrifying. It's a world of acronyms and approaches to problems that you could easily look enormously foolish. And I, the advice I think we offer is, you can ask people for more information about something, but you're going to get pretty boring pretty fast if you've got one question per hour of those. So, now would be a very good time to carry a little notebook and write something down, maybe even phonetically, because you don't know how to spell this exotic thing. And then, of course, these days Google does things which were much slower paced for us in a library-based previous era. But you need to know a lot of stuff, and your colleagues know that often. And I suspect, worryingly, they think you know it when you don't. If you're early on, I don't know if you ever had that experience when you were, when you were training. It's terrifying. I don't know if you have, maybe you have an anecdote yourself about one of those situations.
Well, I mean, I certainly have felt a sort of keen desire to perform in that environment that I felt quite precarious at the time. So you don't know something, but it's important. The others expect you to know this stuff, and you don't know it. And there's a question, I suppose, about how honest we can be about not knowing. How much of that we can get away with, as it were, and how much we should get away with. I guess what you're saying is, if you don't know, admit you don't know, but take down some notes and go and find out. And next time you come back a little bit better informed. I mean, certainly the language, I work in epilepsy, so I started my, post-qualification experience in an epilepsy surgery. I understood probably less than 10% of my first meeting, and gradually, incrementally added some language and begun to understand the wiggly lines, etc. And gradually things start to slot into place. And I think that, for me, it's about having supervision, having other people around you who you can turn to for support, who are maybe keeping an eye on the need for you to perform and the need to be honest about what you don't know. And to sort of maybe rein in a little bit of our desire to be seen as competent in some ways, in conventional ways. So I think that for me is quite important. Those kinds of system-wide pressures on people that might cause them to make mistakes or act with a degree of confidence that's beyond their training is something that I'm quite keen on thinking about. I suppose we talked a little bit about training, particularly in neuroanatomy. You run a neuroanatomy course, and I suppose I wondered. Again, in that last chapter, you talk about, well, how do we balance out these things? There's some stuff you need to know if you're going to avoid making mistakes. But there are ways in which we might have this rather unbalanced portfolio, as I describe, where I might know a lot about neuropsychology and neurocognitive development, but I know very little about the medical language that's being used. And somehow I need to bring these things together. But
So
I might be persuaded to try and pass for a decent neuropsychologist by disguising the fact that I haven't done your neuroanatomy course, and I don't know where the thalamus is, and maybe it doesn't matter, right?
well, I you've given me a nice segue into something we said quite early on in the book, which is about the importance of individual cases, and this thing that in Aluria, because I'm a bit of a Aluria fan, called romantic science. There's something about the description of an individual case or your experience of an individual case that's really helpful. And I remember early in my career thinking that the right moment for me to learn to choose your example, where the thalamus is when you have your first case of a colloid cyst. And you vividly remember what the patient looks like. You go to the textbook and you read what a colloid cyst is, and you understand the anatomy of the thalamus for the first time. And you'll never forget that because it comes grounded with a very vivid life experience. And then tomorrow you'll have a posterior communicating artery aneurysm, and you'll learn something about the vascular system. So I think instead of viewing a textbook of neuropathology or whatever, like some enormous Bible that you need to commit to memory, if you learn them one case at a time, then you'll acquire the knowledge in a much more meaningful way than just rereading the same material. I see that seems to have
Yeah, no, that certainly chimes
struck
with me. There's
forward.
something undigestible about those large human anatomy textbooks. But you did confess that you lock people in a, did you say you lock them in a room to study neuroanatomy?
No, we don't lock them, but they're in Bangor, North Wales, for a week, living in our halls of residence. So there's not a lot of nightlife to be, to be distracted by. Just to reprise what you said before we started the podcast, the principle that I teach anatomy on is that if you can't draw it and label it, you don't know it. So we teach them how to draw something. We show them my painting of it, and they have to turn a blank piece of paper over and remember as much as they can. And there's something about committing stuff to memory that I think is really quite important. I do worry sometimes that we have, in the worst case scenario, a generation growing up now who think that because it would be available on Google, if you needed it, then you don't need to learn it. But n knowing when you need to go to
Yes.
Google is a really important skill, and you need a scaffolding for that. You have to understand. You might have forgotten the details in the mists of time because you learned it 10 years ago, as a trainee, but you need to know that there is such a thing. So I'm a big fan of making sure that our students acquire stuff with fluency. And one case at a time feels to me like the best way forward for that.
And then are there, I mean, I'm persuaded by that. I was thinking about if I was asked to draw a brain, you could tell me all the things that I don't know about the brain based on my terrible drawings, right? And much of it would be true, right? So I think the converse is probably also true, that if I could draw it right, I could probably convince you that I knew what I was drawing and I knew where it sat. If I can look it up on Google, you're probably less convinced that I know it, right? And there might
Indeed.
be times where I need that knowledge that I don't have the time to be able to go. And I suppose there's a time when we become sufficiently experienced, and the expectation is that you've been doing the job for 25 years now. You should know where the hippocampus is.
Well, it's not only that. You need to know what's next to it and what's served, for example, by the same vascular supply. So, hippocampus and primary visual cortex are served by the posterior cerebral artery. If one of those is damaged, I really want to check the other one just out of habit. So, and they're not, you don't need a huge amount of anatomy in order to understand those principles. But the brain is a complicated thing. So you need to know a number of different views and mid-sagittal sections and coronal sections. And because one day a neurologist is going to, or in your case, a neurosurgeon is going to show you a scan, because your patient had, has something in the circle of Willis, and you don't want to sound as if you've never heard of the circle of Willis before, if in that conversation. So anyway, it's not only
No,
anatomy.
I think you're absolutely. I suppose I wondered about, we talked at the start of this conversation about those kind of skills in being able to hold the two languages in mind, the language that the patient's using, the language that we have around cognition, but also the language we might have around neuropathology and brains and systems. There's an awful lot in neuropsychology training to get to grips with. And I suppose my view is that we should try and achieve a balance in terms of covering those areas so that we are balanced individuals. We're not just strikers who can only score goals, but we can also play in midfield and defence, and we can put the gloves on and do a turning goal. So I suppose I worry, and that's stretching your analogy probably a little bit too far, but I think that that we need to be able to be confident we can track back and look at the evolution of that whole process, that we're not disguising our lack of knowledge of neuropathology or of the neurosurgical process with something that's appealing largely to our knowledge of cognition or of the patient's experience, because that patient isn't going to be well served if actually there's a huge gap in our knowledge of what's actually being proposed from a neurosurgical perspective.
I agree with you. I mean, I think neuropsychologists are in a very good place to be a bridge between that really hard-edged world of medicine, and you've used examples in neurosurgery, but also an ability to try to come to terms with the lived life experience of our of our patients. And I mean, we haven't talked much about emotion here, even though that's my thing. But trying to understand the emotional consequences of acquired brain injury for the lives of our patients, of our clients, is really critical. I've spent most of my career in a world in which cognition has been the focus of so much knowledge. Our students arrive, well trained to understand, the clever bits of the mind, as I often call them, and in my experience, very poorly prepared to understand the brain basis of emotion. But actually, that's what our patients and their families complain about, much more so than the cognitive impairments. It's I can't remember. My husband can't remember very well is a problem for me, but my husband is getting angry, and I feel threatened when he loses his temper. That's a much more salient problem, for an elderly couple to bring, for example, in a clinical setting.
And it's an area you've been keen to talk about that. I prepared Oliver to talk to you about the book, but you're enthusiastic about
Sorry.
neuropsychology of emotion. But the clearly it's an important area of work that you have. I suppose I was thinking about that example of someone we might call it irritability or sort of quick-tempered, poorly regulated. We, in terms of that balance of skills and understanding you have as a neuropsychologist, I guess it might be tempting to attribute some of that to the difficult traumatic experience that was the RTA, that was the stroke, that was the aneurysm, that was, whatever it was. And it's hard for us, isn't it, to disaggregate, what the contributory factors are in those kinds of cases.
I agree with you. It is hard to disaggregate, but in a sense, you don't necessarily need to. You just need to deal with the lived experience of the patient, and which tools can you give them that would allow them to to overcome that. We run I suppose a psychoeducation, emotion-based intervention in our local brain injury service here in North Wales. And a key skill for us is early identification of low levels of a problematic emotion, and getting our patients to realize when the traffic light is at amber, so you can do something about it, because by the time it gets to red, it's out of control. And those are relatively simple, dare I say it, concrete. Patients need concrete therapists, examples. And so we need our neuropsychologists to be able to live in with one foot in that space, trying to help our patients to manage difficult feelings, which is a very sort of psychotherapy foot to be having. And then the next morning, they're hanging around with neurosurgeons looking at, scans of the brain's blood supply. So I mean, it's obviously a fascinating world to be, to have the privilege of living in those two camps, but also quite interestingly demanding.
Oliver, appreciate, and it often happens on the neuro clinic that the sort of most interesting things that we could have talked to someone about are the things that we tend to leave out. So I do apologize for not covering a huge area of work that you're no doubt
Don't
involved
worry,
in and
I'm very happy to
excited
talk about
by.
it. I'm happy to carry on talking about the book. It's and there's lots of emotion in the book as well, of course. So
Well, perhaps you'll come back for podcast number two and we could talk again. It's been wonderful talking to you, and I want to thank you very much for this book, which I genuinely felt was for me, and then you mentioned and John Evans, who kindly wrote the foreword for it, is suggesting, those engaged in training or developing in neuropsychology, including those who've been doing it for some time, have a lot to learn from the reflections that are contained within this book. So I think it's an important thing for us to continue to think about. I feel in relation to the work I do in surgery that, as you say, that the people who are successful do send us photographs of their new lives that have been restored via a surgical procedure. Those who are disappointed probably keep relatively quiet about it, and we hear less from them. So I think it's incumbent on us to find out how people are doing, and those who are doing less well as those who are our successes, as it were.
exactly. Well, I'm really glad you enjoyed the book. And you see, it sounds as if you found it a bit challenging as well as, made you reflect on your own practice.
Like all good books should, they've provided food for thought. Jochen Vaur, if I can.
Well, Jan,
Thank you.
Croeso. So you're very welcome for all of this. And it has been absolutely lovely talking to you. And if you can find another way to talk again, I'd be happy to do so.
Thank you, Oliver. Take care.
Okay, well.